Bill Hader, cast member. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so the idea of being on Saturday Night Live was like saying, I'm going to go colonize Mars. I didn't think it would ever happen. My audition process was a little crazy. I was performing in a sketch group in a backyard in Van Nuys, and Megan Mullally saw me in that group because her brother-in-law was in the group. So she said, Hey, you're really funny. And I just said, Oh, thank you. Then a couple weeks later, she called me and said, I just had dinner with Lorne Michaels and I recommended that he see you for the show because I think you're really funny and they're looking for people like you. The Tina Fey era was winding down and people were starting to leave and they needed new people. I had no management, no agent, no anything. At the time, I was working as an assistant editor on Iron Chef America and taking classes at Second City in L.A. When Lorne came to L.A., he came and saw me perform, and it went great. It could not have gone any better. He said, I want to see the show that Megan Mullally saw. And he saw my little sketch group. So our first performance on an actual stage was for Lorne. We had never performed in a theater before. We had just formed. It was really weird. So we did this show, and we killed. It went great. And then afterwards, Lorne said, Everyone in the audience were all your friends, weren't they? And I said, Yes. And he said, Okay. I'm going to fly you all out to New York, and you're going to do a show where no one knows you. So he flew me out to New York, and we did the exact same show, and in the front row was Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers. And it was a writing night. It was a Tuesday night writing night. So they all had this pensive look on their faces like, We've got to get back and write the show. Why do we have to watch this guy? And there were a ton of improv students from New York going, Who the fuck is this guy from L.A.? And that show went really well. Amy Poehler, I remember specifically, started laughing, and it loosened up the whole audience. Everyone kind of relaxed. I've always said, Amy got me the show. And then nothing happened. But 5 months later, I got a phone call for an official audition. I remember going up in the elevator with this guy who had tons of props, and I had no props, and I was like, Oh my God, I should have brought props. That was Andy Samberg. That was how I met Andy Samberg. And Andy said he was looking at me going, Fuck, that guy doesn't need any props. So we were kind of sizing each other up. I did the audition, and then I went back to L.A. A week or two later, I got a manager by this point, and I was with her, and she got a phone call and handed me the phone. It was Marcy Klein, and she goes, You know you got hired, right? And I go, No. And she's like, Oh, well, congratulations, you're hired. And I just thought, Oh, wow. And then she goes, You're going to fly up tomorrow to have this dinner with Lorne. You're flying up with a guy named Andy Samberg, but we don't know if we're going to hire him, so don't tell him anything. Don't tell him you're hired. So I sat next to Andy on this flight, and he's going, God, I wonder what's going to happen. And it was just crazy awkward, and I didn't know what to say. I knew I was hired and was wondering, why would they fly him out and then tell him no, you know? Incidentally, on that plane in first class was Judd Apatow and Steve Carell flying to New York to do press for the 40-year-old Virgin, and the flight got grounded at Dulles Airport because of weather, and so all the passengers had to hang out. Andy and I were too shy to go over and say hi to Steve Carell and Judd Apatow. We were like, wow. We just sat there and stared at them. One of the most persistent challenges to Saturday Night Live over the years has been to keep it youthful, to maintain the kind of impudence and unpredictability that made it great in the beginning. And one way to do that was to augment the series with elements that were not live from New York. Short films were a part of the mix from the beginning, but in the internet era they assumed new importance on the show. Like the medium of American television itself, they graduated from analog to digital and were substantially transformed. The revolution began matter-of-factly, with three junior high school buddies fooling around with newfangled video gear, initially for their own amusement. In time, but not much of it, digital shorts made their first appearance on SNL and became nearly as much of a fixture as Weekend Update. The guiding stars were cast member and writer Andy Samberg and two exotically named friends, Yorma Taconi and Akiva Schaffer. They had formed a kind of video commune they called the Lonely Island even before they joined SNL. Then, with a go-ahead from Lorne Michaels, they began producing weekly pieces. They called their videos digital shorts because, they would later explain, the production quality was so crappy, so much lower than SNL's big-time network standard, that they felt they had to distinguish it up front in the labeling. But Lonely Island proved that filmmaking could now be done, segments conceived, shot, edited, scored, and polished, on the family PC or Mac without looking at all like your Uncle Fritz's home movies, or even the groin-centric clips that flooded the internet and the ABC series America's Funniest Home Videos. Andy Samberg, cast member. I started watching the show when I was 8 years old, and I watched, I'd say, every other episode from 8 years old until I got hired. When I first started watching, it was people like Dana Carvey and John Lovitz and Phil Hartman, and then Mike Myers came in. And obviously Wayne's World was huge for me. And then the next wave that impacted me the most was Sandler, Farley, Spade, and Chris Rock. Lorne Michaels. I guarantee you that Andy wanted to be Sandler. Akiva Schaffer, writer. One of the things that I was interested in very specifically were the short films and music videos that the show had a history of doing every so often. My favorite things like Men's Synchronized Swimming or White Like Me. I had watched those things over and over again. Andy Samberg. Me, Akiva, and Yorma knew each other since junior high school, and we linked up after we graduated college in the year 2000 and moved to L.A. and lived together. Akiva and I were both film majors, and Yorma was a theater major, and we just started shooting stuff together. Akiva Schaffer. Back when we were renting a place on Olympic Boulevard in L.A., I wrote a one-act parody of the Tennessee Williams play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, called Lonely Island, about how lonely it was on this lonely little island in a sea of traffic. Very pseudo-poetic and silly. Then, when we started making little shorts around the apartment, the opening title would be a shot of it with Lonely Island on the screen. And so by accident, that became our name. It's not necessarily a good name. We just got stuck with it. Andy Samberg. We thought we were just building stuff on our own, and we had done a few pilots, The Lonely Island did, and all the while I was doing stand-up for I don't know what reason. I always dreamed of being on SNL, but I didn't think of stand-up as a direct correlation to getting hired there. I even tried, like, a Groundlings audition thing where they place you, but it didn't go well, and the style of it didn't feel like it applied to me. It was too much these rules and these games and build characters. I loved SNL cast members who had come out of Groundlings, but it didn't feel right to me. So we had all this stuff going we were making, but the videos were certainly not why we got hired. Of the three of us, I was the only one doing stand-up at the time, so they called me first to audition. That went well, which I was shocked by, and because of that, somebody said, "So what's the deal with these guys?" And they were like, "They're a group, and they work really well together. They have this website with all these videos." And there was material to be looked at, if someone cared to look at it. So they brought Yorma and Akiva for an audition and had a writer's meeting with Lorne, and I think all of them went pretty well. They hired me first, and then there was a weekend where we had to wait and see if they were going to hire Yorma and Akiva as well. And they, thank goodness, did, as writers. Lorne Michaels. Jimmy had left the show but was working on the MTV Movie Awards with Mike Shoemaker and Steve Higgins. Jimmy called me and said, "There's these guys working on the show as writers, and they're the first ones here in the morning and the last ones to leave. I think you should really take a look at them." So all three came in and auditioned, and I chose Andy. He was the only one I chose. And Mike, I think with Steve, said, "You know, they make shorts." And I looked at some that they were doing, and they were making a series called The Boo, which was a sort of parody of The O.C. And I went, "Okay, bring those two in as writers to work on that." Andy Samberg. I think the idea was, these guys have their own voice, and with Andy as a cast member, we'll have people on the writing staff to help him get that into the show. That is the hardest thing if you become a cast member, translate how you are funny into the show. And I was extraordinarily lucky that they hired those guys, because it's the three of ours sense of humor that I don't think would have existed if one of us wasn't there. Seth Meyers, cast member. All three of them were all really quite talented, and they were great people to be around, but their sketches weren't quite working like the stuff they'd done before. Akiva Schaffer. We were trying to learn this new skill of writing for Saturday Night Live, knowing that what we were really good at was making short films, but we didn't know how to get that onto the show, and we weren't being asked to either. We knew we had been hired together as a threesome, were buddies, and our role was to all work on the same team, the team of getting Andy on the show. Andy Samberg. We were still in that place, halfway through our first season, of not knowing if we were making it on the show, to be honest, because you feel things sort of unflow when you first get there, like you have a good table read but the sketch doesn't work well in dress and it gets cut, or maybe you get something on but it doesn't go well, or the next week you get shut out. There are so many ways to feel like you are not on solid ground there. We were operating out of fear, not out of confidence. Yorma Taconi, writer, director. I think we got a little bit frustrated in the way the show works, bringing things to table and not knowing exactly what would work. I think there's a learning curve for everyone who gets to the show. One of the first things we ever wrote for the show was a musical about a boy who's not allowed to wear his shorts at night because his dad's really strict, a musical where Andy's singing and lamenting about why his father is so strict. And then his father, Will Forte, comes in and tells him to stop singing and go to bed. And Andy eventually has a beautiful dream where he floats away on a pair of shorts into the night because all he wants to do is wear his shorts at night. But it did not go over well at the table read at all. It was just such a weird concept. And we started to realize that some of those weirder concepts were things that we just needed to film and present, because that was the way to show people that it was potentially good or make sense out of it. Filming it was almost a way to circumvent people not understanding why something was funny. And so, one of the first weeks we had off, we went and made a little short called The Bing Bong Brothers, which was a takeoff on the Ying Yang Twins' The Whisper Song, which was this rap song that feels like someone is whispering sexual thoughts into your ear the entire time. And it was just us singing about how we want women to look at us. We borrowed a video camera from Bill Hader's wife, who was working at film school, and shot that really quickly in the West Village and edited it in my apartment, just like on a laptop. Then we were like, oh, this is how to get things done, maybe? This is what we've been doing for years, maybe we should try and do it for the show. Colin Jost, writer. They were initially struggling to find their way sketch-wise in a live show, and then they went out and shot their first thing, which was Lettuce, just a low-budget thing. It wasn't a huge hit, but it worked, and it was a new voice. Yorma Taconi. The first time we wrote was teamed up with Will Forte, a conversation between two guys, and while they're having a conversation, they start eating heads of lettuce. I wrote a lot of stuff with Will Forte and stuff with a lot of other people, too. What's so nice about the show is that it does encourage things like that. It does encourage you taking responsibility for your own humor and being able to present it in a way that can be understood by people, why it's funny. I think it's harder for people who go to the show and don't have that luxury of being able to just go off and film it themselves. I think we would have been decent staff writers, but our run at SNL would not have been nearly as memorable. We had the distinct advantage of being able to create in that way. And I think there's a lot more opportunity today to do something like that with just you and a camera and a mic and make something funny, which is what you see on YouTube all the time, as opposed to the early Albert Brooks films that needed a 35mm camera and a whole crew and editing for probably a week. It's so vastly different, the technology nowadays, that you can get up and have it be late-night quality standards. We edited all those shorts ourselves till like 5, 6 in the morning. From the moment we stopped shooting them, we were either editing in our offices or on very simple programs on the computer till the moment that they aired. That wasn't a possibility even a couple years before we were there, to go and make it all in your office. We would record everyone from Justin Timberlake to Rihanna to Lady Gaga in this shitty little office. It was like inviting someone into your college dorm. Akiva Schaffer. When we first decided we were going to make some short films, we specifically didn't want to go pitch and go write it for the table. Not to stay under the radar in terms of we didn't want this out, but more to stay under the radar in case we failed. Like if we made a video for free on our own time and then it comes out badly, there's no embarrassment there. We can just throw it away and no one knows. Whereas if we asked for a big budget and did it in the system and then it turned out stinky, then maybe we'd never get a shot to do it again. We didn't even have to use real edit suites. We just used the computer that we would write on and edit right there. So we'd just turn in the tape because we were afraid to ask permission and have them say no. So out of fear more than anything else, we went and made the very first one, Lettuce, for $20, and then we made Lazy Sunday for just the cost of the cab fare. Chris Parnell, cast member. Those guys came to the show with a skill set of how to make these videos already, and they came to me and asked me if I'd go to work on one with them, and obviously I said yes. I had no idea it would have the effect it had or the popularity it had. Colin Jost. Lazy Sunday was a huge hit. There hadn't been people doing songs on our show that way probably since Adam Sandler. So it was a combination of a new style, editing it in a funnier and tighter way, and also the music component, which was so strong on its own and was done so well. It was that combination, plus Andy being young and having vitality and freshness, and no one had seen him before. It was a great combination. Think about pitching their first couple of digital shorts, pitching Andy and Forte on a stoop, and there's no camera movement, and they're talking about a breakup and eating lettuce. No one would be like, "Great, let's do that." Or pitching Andy and Chris Parnell rapping about what they do on their Sunday, and you just see some graphic elements on screen moving around. You'd be like, "All right, but I'd really like to see it first." But they knew it was going to be good, and they knew they thought it was funny. And that's the biggest thing here. If you feel like something is funny to you, chances are a lot of other people out there will too. Akiva Schaffer. We did Lazy Sunday in December of 2005, and by the end of the weekend, my brother emailed me and told me, "Look at this place where you can watch it online." Because at that point, you couldn't watch SNL clips online. NBC wasn't putting anything online right after it aired or anything like that. So I was just excited because it was Sunday and I hadn't seen it since we had aired, and I was like, "Ooh, I get to watch it again." And that was YouTube. I have no idea to this day who posted it. And over the next week, as it became kind of a news story, everybody discovered the video, and a lot of people discovered YouTube through the video. And then I got so excited, my very first video. I was checking it every day. Oh, another 10,000 people saw it. No, 100,000 people saw it. By today's standards, if they had 500,000 hits, it was a huge news story. And it was by far the number one thing on YouTube, but the numbers were not, like, obviously what they are today. Chris Parnell. I was home on holiday with my family in Memphis and got a call from Mark Lepas in publicity saying the New York Times wanted to do a big interview with me about this big thing. So that was my first awareness of it. I just feel so lucky to have been a part of that. It was just really cool. Akiva Schaffer. My brother noticed a few things on YouTube that he thought could be improved, and he basically did a teeny bit of research, and I think the company, YouTube, only really had maybe 10-12 employees at the time, and he just reached out to them and started talking to them a bunch about it. And in doing so, he was looking for a job, and he basically was able to create a job for himself there and start working there from then until well after they sold it to Google. He does not work there anymore. Yorma Taconi. Because Lazy Sunday became so popular, I think, We garnered a lot of trust from Lorne, and that allowed us to do whatever we wanted to do. And also, it wasn't a huge risk, because we weren't spending a lot of money making these things. Lazy Sunday cost the amount of whatever we spent on videotape and taxi rides to the Upper West Side to go to a theater, cheaper than building sets for a sketch by far. We eventually started getting budgets and shooting things on better cameras and having crew, obviously. In fact, that happened pretty quickly. Andy Samberg. All the way up until the year before we got hired, we were still recording SNL on VHS tape so we could rewatch sketches we liked. Fred Armisen doing his Native American comic thing on Update. I must have watched that thing like 30 times trying to memorize it. It was so great. People always joke to us about how we made YouTube huge, but I think we were more just fortunate in having incredible timing, that we happened to have something people really wanted to watch at the moment computers got fast enough to stream it. Yorma Taconi. So this was the beginning of wanting to see every week how popular something was, because for the first time, I think, we could quantify the popularity of something we had done in digital hits and downloads. Lorne Michaels. And then NBC had the classic NBC reaction, sued YouTube. It was suddenly on the front page of the business section, The Times, that this startup called YouTube was being sued by NBC. You know, you would think that somebody would have gone, let's just buy this thing or figure it out. NBC announced at every upfront some new digital strategy, but they didn't have any strategy, obviously, and I wanted SNL.com. I said, it's idiotic. No kid goes to a corporate site and looks for a show. But they were so fierce about it. We're building our synergistic NBC.com. And so we weren't allowed to break away. We thought that would have been revolutionary. We would have been Funny or Die or whatever else there was. But they wanted a corporate identity. Seth Meyers. I feel like every so often, SNL needs a shot of adrenaline to get everybody to pay attention to it again. Like those guys and their digital shorts. It just became such a thing that drew people to the show every week. They wanted to see what those guys were going to do. They were as autonomous as anyone has ever been on the show, certainly during the time I was there, in that they would just manage to go off on their own, the three of them, and come up with ideas, week in and week out. They were sort of on a different writing schedule than the rest of the show. As the head writer, I can take no credit for rewriting those spots or giving them suggestions. Every now and then they would shop around ideas, but what those guys pulled off, doing as many of those as they did, week in and week out, was unbelievable. The arrival of those guys and the arrival of how people were consuming media on the web dovetailed together so incredibly well. They were writing sketches every week, and we really liked them. Justin Timberlake, host. There was definitely a different energy in their writer's room. It was almost collegiate. The show itself is a bunch of adults who act like children for a living, so obviously they always fit right in. I guess the funniest thing about working with those guys is I feel like most of what we came up with came out of sleep deprivation. When we didn't have time to think about what was PC or not, or what would work and what wouldn't. What you have with the digital shorts, you have an advantage, which is you have editorial capability, so you can really hit a joke on the nose with the edit. With Dick in a Box, we had this loose idea. We're kind of close to the same age, so we kind of grew up with that kind of 90s R&B group sound when we were kids. So we had this idea about those groups and how to do a joke about guys who were still stuck in that era, which wasn't a long era, like half a decade, I think. And so that's the idea we started off on, and then it was kind of like, how do you get away with them being idiots? And the best way was for them to be as genuine as possible about the gift they were giving, but not totally being at your full wit. Then the digital shorts that came after that were obviously like a spin-off, and then a spin-off of a spin-off. We found that everyone loved those three guys because they were so endearing. So what was so kind of sexist about the lyrics when you looked at the two of them, and this goes back to why you have an advantage with a digital short, because you really can with editorial, you really can hit the joke on the nose with the aesthetic. And I think the fact that we made them look so ridiculous, act so ridiculous, but also so non-intrusive in a way, I think that's what helped it get away with something that seems so misogynistic if it was someone else.
Scarlett Johansson, host. I watched the show all the time growing up. We were big Saturday Night Live fans in the house, so it was a big family event. We all loved Phil Hartman a lot. We were big Phil Hartman fans. For us, it was something that the kids could watch with parents, and everybody loved it. That's the great thing about Saturday Night Live. I remember being very happy that there was a rehearsal, because the idea of the show is so abstract you can't possibly imagine how any of it is going to work, even down to the costume changes. I have 6 wig changes in this short period of time, and you're going to put fingernails on me, and I will have a bald cap and a prosthetic or whatever the hell it calls for? How could it be possible that you could play a Barbie in one scene and like an alien head in another with about 1:36 in between? It's terrifying. And then, of course, you have everybody there thinking, it's old hat, going, don't worry, we do this every week, it's going to be fine. Doing the show is liberating in many ways. I think the thing about Saturday Night Live, in order to succeed, is you have to proceed with a kind of reckless abandon, and I think theater has some truth to that, too. I think they probably have more similarities than they do differences. Of course, you're there in real time with the audience, and I think in both cases the audience wants you to succeed, despite whatever your paranoia might be telling you. To friends and fans of Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Saturday Night Live had to be one of the last places they'd expect her to revisit. She'd said being on the show had been anything but a happy experience, particularly in light of the fiercely competitive atmosphere and the drug use she saw. But in 2006, her Seinfeld triumph behind her and SNL now less cutthroat, Louis-Dreyfus accepted an invitation to return to the show as host, and this time she wasn't bitter. Louis-Dreyfus brought backup, her former Seinfeld castmates Jerry Seinfeld and Jason Alexander, to help with her clever monologue, which ridiculed the so-called Seinfeld curse, a lingering myth that held that all 4 Seinfeld stars were doomed to certain failure in anything they attempted after completing the legendary show. The week's guest star was no less than Al Gore, the 45th Vice President of the United States, then a busy environmental activist. Gore appeared first in a cold open that envisioned the United States as it might have been under a Gore presidency, which was written by his then 29-year-old daughter, former SNL staff writer Kristen Gore. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, host. It was like going back in time and fixing things. Like if you were a nerd and insecure in high school, then you get to go back and not be the nerd and not be insecure. So from an emotional and psychological point of view, it was pretty remarkable to have that experience. I'm really glad I had it, because it kind of crystallized a lot of stuff for me. I went back with a lot of experience I didn't have when I was in the cast, and I had the added benefit of knowing exactly how the show's done and exactly what I needed to do to protect myself going into the process. And it was great. In addition to that, it was being run by Lorne Michaels, and that was a very different creative landscape than it had been when I was a cast member in the 80s. You know, when I hosted in 2006 for the first time, Tina was the head writer. So there was already a very female-friendly culture in place, and a plethora of capable, funny, very strong creative female cast members on the show in addition to the writers. Oh, and by the way, it wasn't until, like, halfway through the week that I discovered that I was the first female cast member to ever return as host. Can you imagine that? I definitely knew that I had to go in with a really strong opener. It's an assload of work to host. At least it was for me, because I didn't want to coast. If you think of the monologue as an SAT exam, that opening is a huge section of your score, and it sets the tone for whether or not you've done a good job. I put a lot of work into it, and I came in with my own material. I wanted to make fun of that whole stupid fucking Seinfeld curse shit that was being bandied about and try to poke a hole in it because it was, of course, absurd. Even though my time in the beginning there was pretty painful, I'm proud of my association with the show. I feel like I was in the trenches, and then to go back was just a kind of personal triumph, a happy one, that's hard to put into words. I think a lot of that is very gender-specific. I think women are better at getting along in a group, frankly. And there are a lot of really funny women in the cast, you know, with Kristen and Maya and Amy and Tina. I'm not suggesting that the men were hostile or aggressive or competitive with one another, but I think there was a culture of friendliness there, and I cannot help but think it had sort of an osmosis effect, and I think it came from the ladies, I really do. Because if you think about the material that was popular at the time and successful, you know, characters that came back and stuff, they featured characters that would have a camaraderie between them that was funny. And you can tell it was born out of a friendly environment because the material had a friendliness to it. That's actually when I met Amy Poehler for the first time, and we immediately got along. And she's actually become a good friend of mine. Not every cast member who leaves Saturday Night Live, and all of them do, eventually, is ushered out with a party and a sketch. Not by a long shot. In fact, most leave quietly when their contracts run out. During the turbulence of the early 1980s, some newly acquired performers were fired before they could appear in a single sketch. At the happy other extreme, Daryl Hammond's talent stayed with the show for 14 seasons, a record. Certainly no one at the show wanted the multi-talented Tina Fey to leave. She remains one of the most important writers in SNL history, as well as one of the top Weekend Update anchors. It was a huge loss to SNL when she departed in 2006, but as the saying goes, it was time. Two other celebrated women left the show during the same era. Beth McCarthy Miller was the program's director for 11 years starting in 1995, succeeding the original, Dave Wilson, who served two terms, 1975 to 1986 and 1989 to 1995, and the first woman to handle that notoriously high-stress job. Rachel Dratch, who left SNL thinking she was destined for a major role in Phase 30 Rock, got shortchanged by history. The 30 Rock gig fell through after the pilot was shot. Dratch was a great TV clown in the tradition of Imogene Coca. Her 7 years of hilarity on SNL comprise an admirable legacy. Among Dratch's best-remembered roles were that of Will Ferrell's spacey New Age lover in a series of uproarious hot tub sketches and the aforementioned Debbie Downer. Horatio Sanz, a versatile and likable SNL sketch actor, apparently had been at least moderately disgruntled since Adam McKay had left SNL as head writer, and chafed at being compared to past superstars John Belushi and Chris Farley, mainly because of his portly physique, later trimmed via dieting and exercise. Sanz could do physical comedy handily, but clearly preferred material that was more political and cerebral. Unfortunately, he didn't get a lot of opportunities to do that during his SNL tenure. Finesse Mitchell, a talented stand-up comic, was a featured player starting in 2003 and became a full cast member in 2005. But the following year he was dropped, the reason given being budget cuts, which can be inflicted on SNL even if ratings and reviews are good. Mitchell went back to his stand-up career and to roles in sitcoms and comedy movies. While Sanz and Dratch were both jettisoned, McCarthy left on her own for perhaps a saner gig, as almost any gig would be. For his part, resident genius Robert Smigel would have one more year before still more budget cuts brought an end to his idiosyncratic tour de force. And Faye? She could have had a lifetime contract if she'd wanted one. But she didn't. Tina Fey. My older daughter was born in 2005, and I was in some kind of development deal with NBC. I remember thinking, oh, I have to kind of build a bridge to something because you can't stay here forever, as much as anyone would love to stay there forever. And so I thought, I'm going to try to write this movie, Mean Girls. I'm going to pitch a sitcom, and I'm going to try to get pregnant and we'll just see what sticks. And all three things overlapped. When my daughter was born in September 2005, I got 6 weeks off and then I went back a couple shows in and I remember that season thinking, why am I here? I remember sitting at a table at the read-through table, listening to someone else's sketch, you know, like the 28th sketch out of 40, and thinking, my baby is at home. I gotta get out of here. I can't do this. Why am I here?
Jeff Zucker. I've been watching the show since I was a little kid. What I remember the most is probably Gilda and Roseanne Rosanna Dana. Having been a producer of the Today Show for almost 10 years, I had a lot of respect for what Lorne does as a producer, and I think the biggest thing an executive can do in those kinds of roles is just support the producers and let their vision speak. There was nothing broken at Saturday Night Live. People are fond of saying certain years are better than other years, but at the end of the day it's all pretty good and pretty special. I actually think that one of the biggest things I wanted to do when I got my job was address the fact that Lorne and this cast have been totally underutilized by NBC. Lorne's road to success on NBC, outside of SNL, began in the early 2000s. We put SNL in prime time with a series of specials and half-hour shows. We also had Lorne do 30 Rock. He also did the Tracy Morgan Show and a few other pilots as well. Lorne Michaels. Tina was really the first one who went into the television business, so she did movies, but you know what I mean. So it took how many years for that sensibility to be accessible in prime time or as part of mainstream culture?
Rachel Dratch. I was supposed to go to 30 Rock, and that... I hate talking about 30 Rock. It was years ago, and that whole thing changed. It was sad. I was kind of on the fence about staying anyway, but I asked, can I go back to SNL? And that was the year they were cutting down the cast, and I don't know, budget cuts and blah, blah, blah. So myself, Horatio, and Chris Parnell were all up. I never really know how to spin my exit from SNL. The deal was it was a year where they weren't just saying, like, yeah, stay for as long as you want. I kind of wish I was able to stick around for a little longer. But back then, people left after their 7 years, commonly. Now, people stay super long.
Robert Smigel. Rachel was literally one of my favorite people in the cast. I love people who are natural clowns and just go for it, with no hesitation and with abandon. Both Rachel and Horatio made me laugh so hard so many times, and for those guys to be let go, it was impossible for me to feel any anger when financial realities required me to leave. I felt like I dodged a bullet that year by staying one more year. Finesse Mitchell. When you're a member of the cast, there's a lot of pressure on you outside of SNL to bring the funny or bring some sort of change to the show that represents a broader audience of what funny could be. There's a lot of hip and there's a lot of urban and hip-hop out there, and there's so many things that could be funny, but SNL doesn't necessarily tap into it because they don't as a whole have that frame of reference. So by the time you're trying to convince them that this is what's really funny and this is what's going on right now, Chappelle would have already done it on Chappelle's show. And then there was the aspect of you may write a joke differently and they just may not get it. Or you may do a reverse joke where sometimes it's kind of obvious that, hey, the black guy is the butt of the joke, I get it, that's funny. But then sometimes you can write a segment from the black perspective where the white person is the butt of the joke and they don't necessarily get it. Sometimes that was frustrating because you couldn't tell if they didn't want to get it or if they didn't get it. Horatio Sanz. When I first got there, Adam McKay was head writer, and our senses of humor were very similar. He had a way with the show that few people had. I think his intention, and our intention, was to make SNL a little hipper. His shows were really going for something different. There's no one smarter than Adam. He obviously had to go on and start making movies, because that's what you do. It just didn't make sense for him to stay any longer. Then when he left, I really felt the show was going to a different place. It was almost like the show spit him out. I really didn't like that the show went from strange funny to being more celebrity-driven, a making-fun-of-celebrities gossip kind of thing. I was kind of on autopilot for those last seasons. I was trying to get scenes on, but I wound up in those weird scenes that were on at 5 to 1 at the end of the show. I'd just show up and they'd write funny things for me and I'd kill in these little things, but I didn't necessarily need my own sketch. Finesse Mitchell. I kind of knew the writing was on the wall for me, that it was my last season. Steve Higgins had told me. He said, "One day, you never know, you might have to come back to host it." So I knew I wasn't coming back. But at that time I was mainly frustrated anyway. I wasn't that happy being there. I wasn't mad or bitter about it, I just wasn't happy. It got to the point where I didn't even remember what made me funny, or what my funny was, and that's when I thought, well, yeah, it's time for a change. Of course, you have those dreams and aspirations going into it if you're the black guy. You're like, damn, I'm going to be Eddie Murphy. And when it's not happening and then you're frustrated, it's, why am I not Eddie Murphy? I want to be Eddie Murphy by now. It's not happening. Horatio Sands. I was at home, I think there was an off week, and I started getting calls asking, "Are these rumors true? Are you fired?" I was like, "No, I haven't heard anything about that." And I hadn't. I had actually been in the offices for a few weeks already. After a few calls, I called Shoemaker and said, "Is there any truth to this, so I can at least not sound like I'm crazy?" But he said there's no truth to that as far as he knew. And I believe him. So after that call, when Shoemaker said it wasn't true, I went back and told everyone, "No, there's no truth to this." I said something to the effect of, "It's probably some fucking executive making something up." And I think that that probably pushed things further. I think maybe they were pressuring Lorne, and Lorne was probably still trying to work something out. But at that point, you know, I'd been there 8 years, so my contract was pretty heavy, you know, because you get more money at that point for every year. I think Lorne discussed, maybe we can pay you less or something. But at that point, it had been 8 years, so I felt kind of squirrely about trying to work there for less money. It felt like a backwards move. I told Lorne, if I don't get update, this will probably be my last show. And he was like, no, I don't want you to quit. And so let's just talk about that later. And so it came as a complete surprise. But also knowing the history of the show and the fact that with my salary they could have hired 3 new guys, I totally got it. I just wish it would have been a little more forthcoming. It felt a little shitty. I just wish someone could have told me beforehand so I could have left on my own terms. All they had to do was say, hey, after this season, we're going to start looking for other people. But being asked to stay and then getting fired? It did sting at first, but I've been cool with it for a while. Chris Parnell. After the second stint, after the 8th season, I heard, does Chris want to come back for another season? And I debated it, not because I'd had a bad time, but I just thought, maybe this is done. But then I thought, look, this is a great job, and if they'll have me back for another season, I'll come back. We threw it back in their court, and eventually they came back and said, no. When I had been let go the first time, that was the hardest thing I've ever been through. I've been on sitcoms where we did 5, 8 episodes and it got canceled, but nothing ever really compared to that earlier departure in terms of the emotional blow that it was. If, going forward, I never have anything that hits as hard as that, I'll be very lucky. It was a huge letdown and such a major disappointment, and I realized to what extent I'd started defining myself as a cast member of Saturday Night Live. It made me start to reevaluate myself and look at myself in a different way. Between Lazy Sunday and Cowbell, I feel like I was a part of 2 pretty classic moments on the show. It ushered in a new era, to be sure. When I look back on it, I mostly just feel grateful and thankful to have been a part of the show, and for that span of time. Even though getting fired was emotionally hard, and a real blow to my confidence and all that, being brought back made me so happy. And I just felt so thankful to be back there and be on the show several more seasons. It was a crazy roller coaster, like somebody said, some high highs and some low lows, and being able to work with the cast members that I did, spanning that original group to who was there when I finished, that was amazing. It all led to some great, lasting friendships, And certainly for me, it not only started my career, it sort of launched me into being able to make a living as an actor. So I have mostly fond memories, and just a lot of gratitude to Lorne and everybody there for letting me be a part of it. I never like to get fired or let go from a job, but I was infinitely more okay with it this time.